You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius.
The ability to speak for people that are at least on the geographic periphery of the kind of like center of the universe is something that, you know, kind of like gets you up in the morning and I guess gets you typing.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This episode, we talk to writer T.M. Wolfe, who wrote the fantastic hip-hop novel, Sound. Sound is not a novel about hip-hop, but rather, as you'll see, a book that uses the techniques of hip-hop music to create an entirely new reading experience. I read the book several months ago and was totally blown away, so when I had a chance to talk to TM, whose given name, confusingly for a writer, is Tom Wolfe, I jumped at it. As a New Jersey native, I especially appreciated that the whole thing was set in an imaginary Jersey Shore town. As always on Outside the Lines, we bring you a special kind of audio footnote. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius,
go to rapgenius.com and search for OTL48. There, you'll find audio, video, and more information to bring you further Outside the Lines. And now, here's our talk with author T.M. Wolfe.
So welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm here with author Tom Wolfe. Not that Tom Wolfe.
Or the other Tom
Wolfe. Or the other Tom Wolfe. So for our listeners who might not be familiar, can you tell us who you are as the author of the really great novel Sound?
Sure. My government name's Tom Wolfe. I go by the pen name T.M. Wolfe because there are too many Tom Wolfes and Thomas Wolfes already bouncing around in literature. Or to avoid confusion at my publishing company when I show up and I say that I'm Thomas Wolfe and everyone thinks that I'm the other guy's assistant or something. It's like, no, I'm actually, I'm an author too. My name is Tom. So I write under the pen name TM. Mm-hmm. My novel Sound was released around this time last year, April 2012, by the Faber and Faber imprint on Forrest, Rouse, and Giroux. It's since been released in the UK and Germany, and we have a French edition coming out October 10th.
Okay, FSG. Shouts to Kathy over there. We love her. Sound is really different than just about any novel I've seen, and so for people who haven't read it, can you explain a little bit about it? It's very different than a lot of books, even down to literally the paper on which it's written.
Sure. So I think probably the big formal hook for the book, the thing that really sets it apart, is that I've written it like a musical score. And basically what that means is that you can see what characters are saying, but you can also see what they're thinking and what they're hearing while they're speaking to each other. And you read dialogue in sort of these big ensembles and strips that go across the page, sort of like you would read musical notation for instrumental ensemble. You can see all the different notes by all the different instruments being played at the same time. In order to deal with some of the sort of technical aspects of just laying something like that out and not fatiguing the reader and the economies of scale for printing, the book is printed on paper that's almost square. It's a little longer than it is wide, but it's a lot wider and a little taller than most books, which is nice. So when you go to a bookstore, it stands out on the shelf.
Rap Genius.
Very, very cool. And one of the main things about it is the way the dialogue is written and the characters' internal monologues. Stuff is layered. Stuff is happening pretty much simultaneously. I guess even though your eye doesn't literally see it simultaneously, the idea is like things are happening at the same time in the book, and that's reflected in the way it's written, in the typefaces, in where it is on the page, all of that kind of stuff. But you had this really interesting comparison in an interview where you talked about how that's similar to the way groups like Wu-Tang will use soul samples, where they'll keep a huge chunk of the original singing and just rap their own thing over it.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I feel like if you listen to a song like Hollow Bones, which is an example I use a lot of the Wu-Tang stuff, definitely, the music, it actually has words in it coming from multiple people and not just the rappers. So there's actually words in the music. And if you were to transcribe all the words that are actually in that song, you would have not just the lyrics from the rappers, but also these chopped up vocal snatches from the beat underneath. And I think that when you first experience something like that in musical form, it sounds dissonant because it is, but you slowly grow used to it and you come to like those sorts of things. And then you say, why can't I use these kinds of ways of putting words together and these concepts of what hangs together outside of what we think is sort of mellifluous, in text, in writing. And so that's, you know, one of the impetuses behind the notation form and sound.
Yeah, I feel like the Wu, Ghostface especially, takes that really to an extreme where he'll just put on a whole Delphonics record beginning to end and rap over it.
Exactly. Or yeah. A song like Cameron, Oh Boy, which popped up on the iPod while I was coming in the way in, where, you know, you just have that Oh Boy fragment going through the song, but it's not just kind of pretty background music or whatever. It's actually, the lyrics are constructed to allow that sample to pop up and complete the bars.
Yeah, yeah. So the book is in large part, and we were talking about this off air a little bit, about the Jersey Shore, and obviously that was devastated by Sandy. First of all, how did it affect the areas you knew on the shore, and secondarily, and I guess, you know, does it have any effect on how you think about sound and the events in it or the characters or anything like that?
So I think there are a couple strange things about living in an area that's been hit by a hurricane. So I visited the shore, the part of the shore where I'm from, about, I guess, 4 or 5 times since late October when Sandy happened. And the first time I came down, it seemed bad, but not as bad as I think I've now come to see it being. So in some towns, you know, about a third of the houses might have been washed away in the storm, and another third, because of the amount of damage they've sustained, needed to be demolished. And then another third maybe suffered no injury at all or fairly significant property damage, but stuff that could be recouped. There are other towns where seemingly nothing happened at all. And mm-hmm. some of that, I guess, has to do with like the fractal qualities of water and the contours of the shoreline. But what you rapidly come to see if you go back in sort of 2 to 3 month intervals is that the damage takes a lot of different forms. And sometimes the damage, the particular forms of damage, are not immediately apparent, and they only appear with time. So you drive down the highway right after the storm and you notice that a third of the houses have been washed away by the ocean, but two-thirds of them are still standing. When you come back 6 months later, another third of them are gone because sometime in the interim they've either fallen apart or they've been taken apart. Or, you know, it's the fall, there are no leaves on the trees, and the storm hits. You come back during the spring and you realize that some of these trees, because of the salinization of the ocean, died and they're not coming back. And you can actually walk up to some of these trees and basically just like pluck branches off of them because they've died completely. You go back now and two-thirds of the houses are gone and there's sand everywhere. And some people have electricity in their homes, but they don't have kitchens. And so it's sort of like people are living half outdoors. And again, like, a lot of those buildings are gone. And there are huge questions about whether they're going to come back, and if they come back at all, what form they're going to take. So there's a certain degree of clean-slatedness about it all. Like, there really could be any number of different things coming out of this, but there's like a real sense of loss because it's very clear that things aren't coming back the way they had been. And in my perspective, it seemed like in the 29 years I'd lived there, not a lot had changed. And all of a sudden, like sort of in one fell watery swoop, everything is gone. So
yeah, and how did, you know, having a novel set in that area pre-storm, I mean, did that change the way you sort of looked at the book or the events or anything like that, or did it kind of seem like they were sort of living in a time before the storm, even though that wasn't what you intended, obviously, when you wrote it?
Yeah, the funny thing is that when I wrote the book, I wanted to set it some kind in the near future of the shore. I guess when I started writing it, the near future was like 2012, and then I got to the point where I realized the near future needed to be like 2015, but not a lot changed conceptually, and it's really not important to the book, but the near future is now very different. Sometimes I wish that I had written a book that actually was a kind of geographically true representation of the place. So I can speak a little bit more, and I've spoken a bit in some other outlets about the kind of remix, geographical remix quality of the town I created. And it has features of real towns that I think you can recognize if you're familiar with the area, but it's not as if there's an actual town like the town that Cincy and Tom live in sound. And now that a lot of these real towns have been altered, it would have been nice to feel like I created this time capsule. Instead, I created some sort of fantasy land that itself is now kind of outmoded as a result of the storm.
Right.
But in terms of what it makes you think about, I do think that the ocean is a presence in sound, but there's not a lot of discussion about what it means. And there's one passage in the book where I described sort of histories of storms in the area, and I had a metaphor that at the time seemed kind of funny, like bay water and ocean water mingling in basements, like cousins at an awkward family gathering or something like that, because those things had happened before. And at the time it seemed like a nice metaphor, but now it's like, oh, those things actually happen, and when those things happen, buildings get swept away. Like, that's not the greatest thing.
You've talked about sound as a hip-hop novel, which normally those words have a very different connotation, right? It's a novel about hip-hop in some way, or people on the come up in the industry, or what sort of euphemistically referred to as an urban novel or whatever, and sound is none of those things. So I was wondering if you could go into what you meant by calling it a hip-hop novel.
So I think that in terms of making it a hip-hop novel, what I was interested more in was not, you know, creating a novel where everything rhymes, or creating a novel that sort of translates into prose form the kind of stories that you hear when you listen to rap, but a book that was constructed using formal principles that I had drawn out of the music. So I think you see this particularly at the level of, kind of at the macro level, of how the plot plays out, to the extent that, you know, the plot plays out. It doesn't have a sort of classic kind of rising action climax, denouement. The idea is instead that things are proceeding this book through cycles and repetition with variation. So later chapters are remixes of earlier chapters. There are not just words, but phrases that recur frequently. And the idea is that we're going to cycle our way through an experience, and by the end of it, we're going to be changed in some way, and we're going to see some things, and things are going to evolve, but there's not going to be a resolution in the way that I think classical plot structures would demand. Mm-hmm. And all of that, you know, is just something that you take from listening to sample heavy music.
Rap G's.
Yeah, I was going to say, I noticed that two words you used a lot when talking about the book were loops and layering, which obviously have their analogs in hip-hop beat making.
Yeah, and we had spoken earlier about Wu-Tang. You know, when you talk about RZA, I think RZA in particular, with vocal samples, this idea of layering. So at a kind of micro level, you get the layering of text in the multi-track sections, where you have not only different characters speaking, but you have characters doing different kinds of things. So you have characters thinking in the present, remembering, projecting into the future. There's music, and everything's written in its own different font. And so you get this kind of sometimes chaotic, but I think beautiful kind of imbrication of all of these different letters, which to me, at least in my mind, was a translation of that vocal sampling technique. I think the one other respect in which I'd probably say these hip-hop structures come into play is the mix between standard prose and the multi-tracking. So you have parts of the book that are, in terms of just the reading mechanics, are a lot smoother because they're formatted like standard paragraphs like we see in every other book. And then the multi-tracking is a little dirtier. It's like a little heavier. It's kind of like the base in the book. And the idea that you're kind of bouncing back and forth between those, sort of like the Roots clones or something, where like all the verses are just like heavy percussion. And then you have not even a hook. It's just kind of like a vocal sample that's very dreamy and kind of very smoothly wends its way. And then after you've had time to digest that, you get back into the multi-tracked kind of percussive parts of the book.
Cool. Yeah, I like that idea of balance and going back and forth between things that are a little more difficult and this tension and release element. Definitely makes sense. I noticed you did a playlist for David Gutowski for Large Hearted Boy, and one of the things on there was something from Ron C. And you mentioned that you liked screw music a lot, and I was just curious about like what if you could talk a bit about that. It doesn't appear explicitly in sound, you know. I don't think anyone's listening to, you know, Ron C or DJ Screw or whatever, but something about when you said you liked that, it rang true to something about the mechanics of the book.
Yeah, I think I can see a couple different things at work there. And it's weird even because this is a book I've been working on for a really long time, so I feel like my understanding of the different pieces and how they fit together in my own mind change with time. But there are certain aspects of the book where they're not even necessarily multi-tracked, but everything just kind of fragments for a second, and the pieces just seem like they're kind of swirling around. There's also an element of what I find very interesting about Screw is like when you slow the songs down, it's like space opens up in the song. And when you take the time to really, it basically allows you to focus in on the silences and the pockets in between sound that you don't normally get because the song's moving so fast. It's like one thing after another. And to a certain extent, I feel like the multi-tracking allows you to really kind of sink into a moment and hear things going on in the silence and kind of occupy the silence in a noisy way. But there's kind of like a tempo switch or something when you're in your processing of the book and you're kind of taken off that line where it's just like word after word after word, and you're allowed to just kind of swirl around in this cloud of words that, I mean, to me seems kind of screw-like. But again, with all this stuff, it's like one medium displaced from whatever I'm getting it from.
Yeah, yeah. And part of this issue of space is just literally space on the page in your book is different than most novels. It's not even something most authors give a thought to, right? You write something and the next paragraph is a space down or not, and you know, line breaks happen where words end automatically, or you know, sometimes you add a hyphen or whatever, but you thought very deeply about space on the page. Or I guess you and there was a designer who worked on the book as well, right?
There was a designer. His name's Jeff Clark. He has a firm in Ypsilanti, Michigan called Quay Medora. He does a lot of poetry volumes in particular. It seems like every time I go into a store now and I see a volume that looks interesting to me, I open it up and it turns out that Jeff designed it. So I'm a huge fan of his. It turns out I was a huge fan of his before I even met him. I just hadn't really paid a lot of attention to who was designing these books when I was reading them. It's another example, though, where I think that for me it was very productive to consider how to put the words together on the page by bouncing my ideas off some other medium. So when I got this idea for using musical notation, I wanted to learn everything I could learn about notation at a graphical level. So I don't have any technical musical training.
I was going to ask her if you were a musician at all.
Yeah. I mean, I played the clarinet for a couple of years, like, you know, in my Catholic like grammar school's band. That's about the extent of it. But yeah, I understand sort of at a spatial level what it's doing. And I had the good fortune at the time to be in Cambridge at university, and they had a really good music library there. So I started looking up their scores and spent time with John Cage scores, Earl Brown scores, just to get a feel for how they were using space on a page to represent the relationships between sounds. And once I saw something like that, I felt like that is a short step to like E.E. Cummings, which is like a short step to something else. Like the sizes of letters, their spacing on the page, they're all tools. Like all writing is, in my experience, is like bold, but and it's probably not entirely true, but I feel like it's a tool for expressing and it's a tool for thinking. And the way you use those tools not only allows you to express yourself and to think, but it also kind of enforces some constraints on how you express yourself and how you think. So to the extent that you can limber up the tools a little bit, you may have the ability to express things and think about things in ways that you otherwise wouldn't, that become productive for you, hopefully.
Rap genius.
Very cool. The other thing I wanted to mention, you mentioned being in school in Cambridge there. I know that you have a pretty extensive academic background. Mm-hmm. And most people in the arts, when they have a academic background of note, tend to elide it or hide it or not necessarily, you know, talk about it so openly, or are dismissive of it. Yeah, I did that, but you know, I learned everything I needed to know, you know, outside of the academy. That was just, you know, a trip that didn't lead anywhere or whatever. And your approach to it has been very different. You've openly acknowledged, I think, its influence in how you approach these kinds of issues in art and things like that. I was hoping you'd talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, as you get older and you spend more time out of school, and it seems like sometimes I'm out of school and then I'm back in school and I'm out of school again, I'm like currently out of school, you realize that, yeah, there are limited things that you can learn in school. Like life is very broad and it's not just limited to reading books and like showing up to class and listening to lectures. But all of that being said, like I think that if you're being educated well, you are challenged to get your mind to operate in as many different ways as possible. And I think particularly, I'm not even now talking about like graduate school or even college, but I'm thinking about like grammar school and high school. Like my understanding is that like the mind is a pretty powerful thing if people will cherish it and give it attention. And if you have the ability to be around people and who will challenge you to expand your mind and work with you on different ways of thinking about things, you become more versatile as a person. I also think that it's sort of hard to be It's hard to talk about why I talk about the things that I talk about without acknowledging the fact of where they come from. So just like to the extent that I find sound interesting, I'm not going to pretend like those ideas just popped in my head magically from somewhere. It's because I've been going around and I've been listening to music and I've been reading books and I've been reading poetry and I've been going to art exhibitions and I've been talking to people and visiting museums and experiencing life and talking to teachers and talking to fellow students. Like all of these things come into your head and they make you who you are. So to the extent that I had schooling in theory and I had schooling in urban planning and I'm now functionally a lawyer, like all of these different things affect the way I understand the world. And I feel like in order to invite people into that world, they kind of have to understand where you're coming from. And you know, that's where I come from.
Yeah, and I know that touches on something else I wanted to talk about. You know, you've operated both in the field of politics and in the field of law, which are, you know, about as far from what people envision kind of the world of the novelist, you know, as you can imagine. Like what did you learn being in those worlds? That did any of that kind of make its way into, you know, T.M. Wolfe the writer?
I think so. I mean, I think that, for instance, it would have been pretty hard to get my final couple of chapters in sound to a place that was satisfying to me had I not been in law school at the time. Like, there's the sort of conclusion of the book where Cincy and the rest of the guys from the Yard go to the prosecutor's office and they tell their stories. And, you know, there's this notion that Cincy is never going to be able to communicate directly to you this kind of unified sense of what happened and like who he is and who all these other people are. All of this is going to be put together in the head of the individual reader, and the individual reader is going to combine that story with someone else's story and their experiences, and that's going to cohere in some way that's going to be the story for them. And like that's just how jury trials work. And there, to a certain degree, I think in law you have to be comfortable with the fact that you can tell your story, but the process is going to arrive at the truth by some other means and just taking you at your word. So I think, you know, without law, it would have been hard to settle that. I think that when you're referring to politics, this is my time working on the Obama campaign out in the field, and most of my job was just going out and speaking to people. And I think that some of the things that you hear from the character Tom in the book and some of the things you hear from Tone in the book are things that either were told to me or things that I learned while I was out there. And one of the most important things I ever learned from anyone was the basic thing that, like, you never know what you're going to get until you ask. And that's something that Cincy struggles with a lot through this book, where everything is so interiorized and he kind of wants to arrive at the conclusion and define the story of everything that's impacting his life at the time by sort of introspecting. And at a certain point, like, you can't do that. At some point, you need to sort of jump the gap between you and the world and you and other people. And the productive way forward is to just, like, ask the questions you want to ask and say what you want to say and then have those conversations with people. And it's through that that people emerge in their fullness, you emerge in your fullness, stories are formed, and you don't find, like, the truth, but you find these truths, these stories that people build between each other that allow them to kind of move forward together.
Sure. And that's something that most of the time is lacking in his relationship with Vera, since he's the main character and you know, Vera, the kind of love interest in the story. There's this wall between them throughout the novel almost, caused at least to an extent by Cincy's sort of inaction and refusal to talk to her, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or to talk to her about meaningful things or where their relationship or such as it is.
Yeah. And I think that that element of the book functions on, like, at least two layers. So one of them is sort of a story about interpersonal relationships. So you have Cincy, he meets Vera, he is enamored with her, but it's all sort of surfaces. So when she pulls away, he doesn't have any way of understanding why she's doing what she's doing. And instead of sort of, like, taking the risk, making his feelings known or making his thoughts known or his concerns known or his questions known and sort of approaching her in some way, he tries to solve her by thinking about her. And, you know, I wrote the first couple chapters of the book in a way that you could, if Vera had said or did 27 things, you could kind of pick subsets of them and string them together, and she would look like one thing or she would look like another. And that kind of setup is prime for Cincy essentially to abuse, like, intellectually, because he likes to take all these different pieces and construct all these different stories. And I don't want to spoil that aspect of, like, the plot, but over the course of the book, Cincy comes to realize, primarily through the writing of the book, it sort of explains how sound comes to exist, that at some point you have to leap that gap. And the book you're reading ends up being his first step in bridging that gap. Mm-hmm. Like, he finally gets down and says what he wants to say and all sort of, like, confused naughtiness and throws that out into the world, because it's only when you do that that I think people can really start becoming real to you. The other axis is that I tried to use the relationship between those two characters to probe kind of, like, at one, like, theoretical level up, which is just our relationship to, like, concepts of truth. Like, so we want there to be this, like, perfect thing out there that we can just look at and, like, know and understand, and everything is completely, completely transparent. And you can kind of, like, hold it and have it make sense to you. But I don't really think there are many things like that. And, you know, this is a pragmatic thing. So this is, you know, where I'll be, like, very bald. This is, like, something that I've been thinking about a lot when I was in undergrad, reading The Pragmatist, is, like, what it means for there to not be, like, a metaphysical concept of truth. And then specifically, like, what that means for our interactions with people. And it's, like, there's always a gap between you and another person. Like, there's a gap between you and the world, and you have to interact with these people and you have to interact with the world in order to, like, understand who they are and who you are. And it's through, like, an interchange. So, like, with nature, it's like science. And then with people, I think it's just conversation and, like, getting to know people in their fullness and giving them an opportunity to speak.
Cool. And That touches on something else I wanted to ask about, which was, I don't know if you saw the review of Sound in Slate that Maura Johnston wrote. But one of the things, the main thing she focused on was lack of development of Vera. And she saw that as a problem in the book as opposed to, you know, many other characters. And I saw like one or two other critics mention that. Do you view that, looking back on it, as a failing, or do you see that as like you were saying, something you wanted, something that was intentional, that she's sort of supposed to be a cipher that Cincy tries to puzzle out? And do you think you were maybe not clear enough in communicating that, or I mean, it's kind of one of your...
Yeah, it's a knotty dynamic. The tricky thing, though, is that the form of the book does weird things to your understanding. So if I view this book in particular as being kind of like an experience engine where you're dropping someone into the head of a character, and it's through being inside the head of this character that you figure something out about how we interact with the world and like how we see things or how we might see things. And so to the extent that you as the reader have the ability to know what any of these individual characters are like outside of Cincy's head, it complicates the communication of the message, because the point is that no one, not even the reader, is going to have that privileged view on the person that solves the issue. And instead, you have to get to the point where you are sort of frustrated by the closed-offedness of the perspective to realize, like, you need to make the jump. And, like, people are only going to emerge in their fullness once you speak with them and give the opportunity for interchange and exchange.
Okay, that actually makes a lot of sense. And one of the things the book, and in some of your interviews that I've appreciated, is, you know, as a fellow New Jersey native, the way you talk and write about the relationship between New York City and New Jersey rang very true. Even just your phrase of calling the influence of New York on New Jersey, even down to its southern end, a blast radius. I thought was, like, as soon as you said that, I was like, that's completely, you know, exactly right. You know, it's invaded by, you know, television, and it's sort of the center of our lives, even if you go there once a year or whatever. And so for those who didn't have the good fortune to grow up in New Jersey, can you talk a little bit about what that looks like from the sort of bridge and tunnel side of the world?
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like the kind of New York-New Jersey dynamic works itself out kind of with New Jersey and everywhere. So there are a lot of people who sort of like scoff at New Jersey just kind of off the cuff. And you're sort of like, why? Why is that? And it's like partially because of its depiction on TV, I guess. Part of it, New Jersey has just got kind of a bad rap. And I mean, I know that like not every part of the state is amazing, but like not every part of any state is amazing. And I feel like I personally had the opportunity to grow up in like a very beautiful and interesting part, not just of like New Jersey or the country, but like the world. And so to the extent that there is kind of a dynamic at hand where you feel like New Jersey is kind of looked down upon. And so the ability to kind of boost it up for other people's consideration is great. I think there is also a sense in which when you're speaking about literature, like the literary world is centered in New York. Even though there's lots of stuff going on everywhere, a lot of the publishing houses are there, a lot of the media outlets are there, a lot of writers live in New York. And so to be a writer from New Jersey, you feel like you're kind of on the periphery in a sense. So the ability to speak for people that are at least on the geographic periphery of the kind of like center of the universe is something that, you know, kind of like gets you up in the morning and I guess gets you typing.
Rap G's.
Very, very cool. Can you talk a little bit about Cincy and Tom, their relationships, their contrasts, the way they set each other off?
Yeah. So Cincy is kind of part and parcel with the form of the book. So he kind of circles and cycles and he's very ambivalent and he has like 18 thoughts about everything. And kind of meanders his way through the summer. And Tom is, to kind of both set that off, point up and kind of amplify the fact of that kind of cyclicalness, but then also to give the story a little bit more momentum, is like the voice of the linear narrative, where for him it's just A to B to C to D. Things are very simple. Things just kind of happen, and other things happen, and then you're at the end. And I think that the sort of interplay between them sometimes is really funny, because there are things that Cincy makes way more complicated than they actually need to be. But there's sometimes where like Tom misses the point too, because he's not like sufficiently expansive to kind of get everything that's going on. But like kind of at a second level, when you reach the end of the book, you learn that Tom and Cincy have like recorded the book together. And there is very much a sense in which like sound, despite the fact that there are all these different formal things going on in it, still is a novel, and it still has like large aspects of linear narrative in it. And
right, I mean, there's still a I don't want to say traditional necessarily, but a whodunit aspect.
Yeah, and
to
I
the
mean,
story.
There's a plot, and like some things are resolved and some things aren't. And you know, without those sort of basic tools in your kit, and without those tropes in your kit, and metaphors in your kit, and way of putting words together in your kit, it's kind of hard to produce anything.
And this being Rap Genius, of course, I definitely want to talk to you about hip hop. But I know you're a huge hip hop fan. You know, comes through in how you wrote the book and plenty of stuff you've talked about. And you used to write hip-hop record reviews, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I started writing reviews for OK Player in 2005, right at the time they started up their album reviews. And did that for, it's like 2.5 or 3 years. Wow.
Did that change how you listen to music at all, having to, like, knowing you had to listen to these albums and come to, like, a definitive opinion pretty quickly?
Yeah, I guess I felt like I was slightly on more of a mission when I was listening to music at that point. So, you know, one of the things that's interesting about like cultural journalism of any kind of form is that you have people out there who are consuming all this kind of culture to tell other people about it. But sometimes it seems like the universe of what's being spoken about becomes very small very quickly. Like conversation tends to cohere around a few things. And like with hip hop, it ends up being like the major label albums primarily. That if you're a listener, like if you know anything at all about the music, you kind of already know what a lot of this stuff is going to sound like before you hear it. And you also probably will know about these things and learn about these things, even if someone's not telling you about them, like on the internet. And so I felt this kind of drive to go out there, like onto the web and like find things that virtually no one else was listening to and try to give that a platform, because I felt like all the other stuff was going to be spoken about by someone else and they'd probably do a better job on it.
What was your favorite discovery during your time doing that?
There were a couple things that I discovered, and most of them came really early in the time. One was Edan's Beauty and the Beat.
I love Edan, definitely. I lived in Boston for a while, so he was always around.
Yeah, I heard that he used to like freestyle for people on the street. And, like, is that apocryphal? I don't know.
I never saw it. Doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Might have been Percy P. I can't remember who did that. But I mean, I thought that was an amazing album. It was like the second album I reviewed. And so I think I gave it a 4. But I think in retrospect, I would have given it a 5. But it's like, you know, at the time you're listening to it, you don't realize that it's going to be one of the best things you hear in like 3 or 4 years. And then also I stumbled upon Omega Watts, who's a producer out in Seattle who also raps. And I thought his stuff kind of had a like Jurassic 5 meets Native Tongues kind of vibe to it. There's a little more like turntablist aspect to it. I really enjoyed that. I think those two albums are the ones that stand out the most. So Edan's Beauty and the Beat and then Omega Watts The Find. Like, unfortunately, again, those are like two albums that I discovered in the first 3 months. And I felt like kind of everything else suffered as a result.
Right, definitely. And I noticed your tastes for someone who grew up in the Northeast are pretty Catholic, right? It's like not region specific in the way that a lot of East Coast heads are.
Yeah, I mean, like, I feel like there's a really complicated arc with all of that too, where at an earlier point in my life, probably I was about like 18 or 19, I probably only listened to rap music coming out of New York. And then when I went to college, I started meeting people who were from other parts of the country who never forced me to listen to anything, but they would like, you know, mention things, and I was naturally curious, so I'd want to go like pick it up and listen to it. Like I had a friend on the track team, and that's how I got into like Houston music and things like that. But the weird thing was, like, up until I was about 21 or 22, I didn't listen to anything except things that were kind of hip-hop and like within the kind of hip-hop sampling lineage. So I'd like listen to jazz and I'd listen to soul. I'd listen to like a little dance hall because stuff like that would get played on Hot 97 like on Sunday nights. And so those were like aspects of my listening. When I moved to England, the third day I was there, like right after I digitized all my music, and this was like I think a year after iPods were invented, I was just going to bring my iPod over there. I plugged it in to update it, and I think I screwed something up, and I ended up like magically deleting like 95% of my record collection, like both on my computer and my iPod. And that was like made me really distraught for like a number of different reasons. And so I ended up borrowing a lot of music from a friend whose musical tastes sort of overlapped with mine in the sense that he liked like loop-based music and he was into some electronic music, but, you know, very, very different from what I was used to. And since I didn't have anything else to listen to, I spent a lot of time listening to his music, and that just kind of like completely blew apart my listening habits. So now I feel like, even though hip-hop is kind of my core genre, I'll listen to stuff from everywhere, and like I haven't gotten to the point where I think I'm particularly good in like describing things to people, but I have a better sense of what I like and how to find things that I like, and so to that extent I feel like a little more comfortable as a listener.
Excellent. And I know you're a fan of someone who's an office favorite on our side of the house, who's Currency.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I feel like I probably listen to too much Currency. I still do.
You can't keep up, though. I mean, even if you were to listen to too much, it still wouldn't be everything he puts out.
Yeah, if you listen to every song more than once, like, you're already going to be behind.
Right.
I spoke to someone about this last year, and I was really enthusiastic, and, like, my enthusiasm for the music hasn't really changed all that much. Like, there's just something about the kind of faux laziness of the rapping.
Right.
Like, when you listen to his vocal tone and you're not paying attention to the words he's actually saying, it seems very laid back and off the cuff. And then when you actually focus on what he's saying, if you're looking at it in terms of like subject matter or topic and just saying like, what is he speaking about? Like, it's nothing revolutionary.
Sure. But like that's actually a lot of artists. I mean, that's
You know, for all genres, like everyone's talking about the same things everyone's always talking about, but his particular way of like putting words together, his way of like sliding jokes in without drawing attention to the fact that he's sliding jokes, the way of boasting in a way that doesn't sound like boastful at all. Like really, really well done. And it's astounding to me that, you know, I have like hundreds of songs from him and I'm still not tired of listening to it.
Definitely. Other than him, who are you digging these days?
So I'm like slowly digesting the Yeezus album, Run the Jewels. I haven't gotten Magna Carta yet, so I don't have an opinion about that.
Run the Jewels might on the low, I might end up liking it better than both of those other two you mentioned. We'll see what happens.
It's totally possible.
Yeah.
Like Killer Mike's rap music from last year was a really good album. There's a duo, I guess they're technically like a production and design duo that's based in Brooklyn, the Stuyvesants. They have a website. I think it's like thestuyvesantsbk.com or stuyvesantsbk.com. Just Google the Stuyvesants. And they've got all these beat tapes that they've made that are for free download, and I just picked up like 100 tracks for free. And I think that stuff is great. It's got like a kind of jazzy sample based feel to it, but like pretty amazing slight flip on that formula, like really refreshing. What else have I been listening to? Are you concerned about hip-hop or just like any genre?
I mean, anything across the board, you know?
Yeah, I've been listening to a lot of the most recent Bonobo album. He's like a down-tempo producer from England. I think the album got kind of mixed reviews. It's called The North Borders. I like it a lot. Like, it's very subdued. It's very easy to listen to the whole thing. And he had a vocalist on his first track called Grey Reverend, who I guess is basically a folk singer, who I think is also based in Brooklyn. And his stuff is great. Like, I've since gone back into his catalog, and I think he has a new album coming out, and I've really liked his stuff. Spree Wilson just released an EP that he describes as kind of like early 90s in Atlanta summer music, like walking through a mall, that I've like zealously foisted on a lot of people that I think is really good. It just sets like a nice beat. I feel like actually in general, it's been a really good year for music, both in terms of things that like everyone seems to be focusing on and then random things that I've been finding on the internet.
Yeah. And what was your, what, do you remember your sort of initial introduction to hip hop? Or, you know, at what point you really said, hey, you really got sort of taken by it?
Yeah, you know, growing up like in the New Jersey suburbs at the time I did, I feel like everyone through some combination of like their cousins and their relatives and TV like learns about like Criss Cross and MC Hammer or whatever. I guess it was like late 80s, early 90s. But I didn't feel like I really got into hip hop until maybe like fourth grade. And then sort of on a whim one day, I like turned on the radio and I was twiddling around because I was bored and started listening to Hot 97 and then just kind of like went from there from the time I was like 11 or 12, I guess. I don't know how old you are when you're in fourth grade, maybe younger than that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, at that time, that was like a very good education in the New York sound. And, you know, all that, all of my experience from then forward was basically like, I guess, based on Hot 97's programming from like 1993 to 1998 or something like that.
not a bad basis to have to,
yeah,
you know,
good.
Move forward in the world. Excellent. Cool. And what about, you spent a lot of time, you know, talking about producers and imagining your novels as sort of hip hop productions in themselves. Who are your favorite producers?
I'm a big Dilla fan. I guess everyone is at this point. I really like Dilla. I like Madlib. I listen to a lot of Madlib when I write. You know, his beats just kind of have a groove, and they're like inobtrusive, and they're kind of dusty, and they give you like a slightly like otherworldly feel that's nice when you're writing. A big RZA fan, Pete Rock, Premier, kind of like all those core producers. More recently, I'm not sure that I have people that really stand out to me. Some projects that I've liked. I mean, Harry Fraud, I like a lot of the stuff that he does. The Alchemist project with Currency from a couple years ago was great. I'm not necessarily a huge fan of everything Alchemist, but I thought that album in particular was great. Yeah, I'd say that's probably, you know, and Organized Noise is another group that really stands out to me. Like, their sound is very distinctive. And when you hear it today, it still sounds, like, very fresh. Like, a song like Creep, when it comes on the radio, you're like, you know, this is a song that needs to be listened to. And it's a shame that, that particular style has kind of fallen by the wayside. I feel like sample-based music still represented, not, like, very heavily on the radio, but, like, there's still a lot of groups out there doing stuff like that. And there's a lot of groups out there doing stuff that's more like synthesized now, but that kind of like jazzy, fully instrumentalized music is something that I feel like we're missing at this point.
Cool. And what if you want to or can talk about it? What's coming up next for you as a writer?
Yeah, I feel like I have some things in my head that are becoming kind of novel-y, but I'm not sure that I have. Like a novel. Some of the ideas that have become kind of interesting to me. One is, I guess this would kind of go back to one of your questions earlier about what Sandy has done to my thinking about sound. I'm very interested now in these questions of what our interactions with nature do to our understanding of memory and like what our childhood consisted of. I think that when you grow up at the beach, you feel like, particularly when you interact with people who like don't grow up on bodies of water, that you have like kind of a pure, more natural connection to the things around you. And so in that sense, your childhood seems sort of like protected and harmonious. And then when a storm like this happens, you realize that in many senses, the lifestyle you were living was kind of environmentally irresponsible, like building large houses right on the water, the degree of pollution in the water.
I was going to say, even, you know, parts of sound or stuff you've talked about around sound were, you know, pre-Sandy concerned with the environmental costs of shore life.
Yeah. You know, surfing, all these different kinds of things. Like, the best waves come when there are storms. And so, you know, it leads you to sort of question, like, well, what exactly was my relationship to, like, nature? And, like, was my childhood really that, like, pure? There are aspects of that. I'm very interested in office building architecture. I have been for a while, but I'm increasingly interested in, to the extent this is true, I don't know, it's sort of a theory, but like what emerging styles of office building architecture tell us about like corporations' relationship to the world in general and like the neighborhoods they inhabit. Like life inside like corporate settings is becoming interesting to me. These are all different things that I'm sort of like slowly probing my way through to see what comes out of them. But I feel like, yeah, it's been productive territory. I just don't know what's going to come out of it.
Nice. Well, we look forward to seeing whatever does come out of it and hopefully, you know, additional thoughts about it on your Rap Genius verified account.
Sounds good.
All right. Excellent. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Yeah. Thank you for your support.
Of course.
That was our chat with author T.M. Wolf. If you enjoy Outside the Lines, make sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @OTL_podcast. You should also find us on iTunes to make sure you never miss an episode. While you're there, leave us a review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get amazing guests like T.M. Wolf. Make sure to join us in 2 weeks when we talk to a true hip-hop legend, Raheem from Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. Outside the Lines is created and written by Sean Sotero, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
There's just something about the kind of faux laziness of the rapping.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
And the pieces just seem like they're kind of swirling around.
Our music is by Psionic.
He'll just put on a whole Delphonics record beginning to end and rap over it.
Exactly.
And special thanks to Kathy Deneman at FSG for hooking up this interview.
And obtrusive, and they're kind of dusty, and they give you like a slightly like otherworldly feel.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks, Outside the Lines.
Cool.